Hey everybody, it's Nick Gunn with Wandering Angus Cider Works from Salem, Oregon.
This is Dave White from Whitewood Cider Company in Olympia, Washington, and you're listening to Cider Chat.
And you are listening to Cider Chat.
Episode 4. Yes, it is the season where fermenters are bubbling away. The airlock is releasing CO2 from the sweet cider that is fermenting into quaffable cider that you and I will enjoy. I certainly have some cider down in my basement, and that's the bubbling that you heard in the background there. And I imagine you do too, whether you are a commercial cider maker or you are a what they call amateur cider maker, although I'm a little offended by that because I don't feel very amateur. I mean, you know, it's not quite right setting for us. I'm a homemade cider maker, and I don't feel amateur at all, having made it for 20 plus years. However, I digress. Too funny. Look, my name is Rhea Wincoller, and I am the Cider MC for Cider Chat, and I really welcome you to the show where we're speaking to cider makers and cider enthusiasts around the world. And this is a weekly podcast that goes live each week on Wednesday. So thank you for tuning in. Look, we got a great show this week, and I want to get into chatting with a guest who I spoke with at Berkshire East. But before I go there, I want to thank Phil Kennedy of Real Cider Company from the UK for reaching out to Cider Chat, and also the Pony Shack, who is based in Massachusetts. Thank you, and I look forward to speaking to both of those cider companies in coming weeks. Meanwhile, I really want you to hold on for the end of the show when we go to a list that Peter Montgomery of Montgomery Gardens LLC sent me, a reading list for the winter that you could delve in deep. If you're interested in knowing more about the apple and cider making, Peter has a list for you and I. Of course, there's a lot of books to read, and we'll be talking about those too in upcoming episodes. But for now, we're going to head to Berkshire East, who hosted the Cider Day Salon and Harvest Dinner for Cider Days in Franklin County, Massachusetts this year, 2015. We're going to be speaking to Nick Gunn and Dave White, and I hope you enjoy this cider chat.
Well, why don't we start with you, Nick? You're from Washington?
Oregon,
I'm sorry. Washington, Oregon. You know, does it matter?
They're so close.
Okay, yeah. I'm nervous right now. See, I'm nervous. You could see, yeah.
West Coast presence.
So we have a cidery that we started 11 years ago now. So we're one of the older, with air quotes, can't see on radio my fingers, but that is an older cidery, not the oldest, but been doing it for a while. We have an orchard in Salem that we grow cider apples on. It was started by my wife and I in 2004, and we started with about 400 cases or so of French and English cider apples, mostly ciders that are based off of drier European styles. And we've kind of gotten into, over the years, making some more sessionable ciders that are just more approachable to drinkers across the country. That's our Anthem line of ciders. So In all, we're doing about 20 different ciders now, and we've grown a lot over the years. So we're really having a great time. We still make 100% fermented apples, some other fruits, but it's been a fun ride, and we're excited to be part of the cider movement.
Yeah, 11 years. That is a long time in ciderland, no doubt.
Relatively, yeah.
Yeah, it is. Well, for the U.S.
Exactly,
Definitely for the U.S. Cool. So we have Oregon, and Salem, Oregon's a little bit south of Portland.
Yeah, it's in Salem's the cherry city. So, yeah, it's a fruit packing kind of center. So we have a lot of great cherries, not as much as some areas, but blueberries, berries, a great wine region.
Yeah.
And that's actually how we got started making cider, is my wife's parents started a winery back in the 70s called Bethel Heights Vineyard. And so my wife and I learned how to make wine and then just translated that knowledge of winemaking over to cider making. And it's the same thing. I mean, it's basically just using a different fruit. We're making a tank fermented Chardonnay, more or less. We're just using apples instead of grapes.
Well, let's give her a shout-out. What's her name?
My wife's name is Mimi Castile. The love of my life.
Lovely name.
She's great. Mimi that. And her family and her parents, Pat and Ted, Pat Dudley and Ted Castile, they started Bethel Heights Vineyard. They're probably like the eighth oldest winery in Oregon. And we actually live out at the farm. So we have 35 acres at our place and another 100 acres of Pinot, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay at another place, in addition to our cider apples. So we're kind of very literally rooted in growing fruit and fermenting fruit. It's just part of what I married into. I married above my station. It's a good household to be married into. It's
well,
fun.
I won't be the judge of that, but obviously you married well.
Yeah, so I married well.
And I'll leave it at that. And Dave, we have Dave from...
Olympia. Yeah, Olympia, Washington.
And Dave White, I want to
say
that.
Yeah. Well, my partner Heather Ringwood and I have been making ciders. We're a younger one in a smaller cidery, a nano cidery, as if you will. We've been making ciders. We're on our third season of bottles. Yeah. I've been involved in cider. Well, a good long time. I started out as an early cider blog, mapping the growth of North American ciders, mm-hmm. and talking about specifically, you know, apple-centric traditional ciders. I always knew I wanted to make cider, and in 2012, we started our first apple crush press fermentations, and 2013 released our first bottles. We're still fairly small. We're definitely dedicated to apples and palm fruit only. Haven't done anything with pears yet.
You have your own orchard?
No, we don't, but it's in the plans. Just south of Olympia is kind of where we're looking. We'll always be apple buyers, and we'll always look to partner with, you know, specialty orchardists and trying to get, you know, the best fruit in Washington. And, you know, Washington's the biggest apple-growing state in the country, but it's still kind of hard to find the fruit that we like to ferment. You know?
The cider apples.
Yeah, cider apples, yeah. And, you know, solid heirloom fruits, mm-hmm. that are proven, mm-hmm. cider fruits.
Yeah. So how did the two of you know each other? Because you traveled to Cider Days here together, and you're like the
I can't stand this guy. I mean, truthfully, do I have to be honest about this?
Well, that's up to you.
Dave, because of his past blogging career, Dave was really the original cider blogger, one of the original cider bloggers, and he's known... In our world, we haven't had a lot of press people, and so when Dave started coming out and writing stories about cider, he wrote stories about visits to our place, he tried our ciders, talked about them, but then he went across the country, and his love of cider, like, was an instant kinship. I found friendship in him right away, because I'm super passionate about cider, and we can geek out together. Yeah. Immensely, and we get along really well. So, I mean, we've talked about doing more travels and doing some trips to Europe. This trip out here to the East Coast is kind of the first time we've been able to actually take a trip together. But most people in the cider industry get along really well, and we just happen to be two more laid-back gentlemen. So we're having a fun trip, and we're very like-minded people. So, yeah, that's kind of my side of it.
Well, you know, we chatted a bit, and decided we both wanted to come, and I found out that after years and years of dealing with Steve Wood and Farnham Hill, that Nick hadn't been to his place. I was like, oh, well, that's it. You know, that's we got to go.
Yeah.
And so we're actually just coming off a night spent at Steve's place and some orchard tours and some ciders, late night ciders with Steve and... Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we also know each other through the Northwest Cider Association, mm-hmm. Which, you know...
Can we talk about the Northwest
Cider Association? Yeah, of course, for sure.
You mentioned that. So, what is the mission? Let's just start at the really basic kind of like thing. What would you say the mission of that is? Just connecting cider makers, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Initially, and you know, Nick and James and Wandering Angus were one of the early like 8 members. There were essentially in 2010 when we started it up, there were about 8 cider makers in the Northwest. Mm-hmm. And these guys were kind of leading the way in size and quality. Mm-hmm. And definitely their membership meant a lot to us. But it was really to bring cider makers together and then potentially be a marketing machine for us together to get more people drinking cider in the Northwest. I mean, I'm not sure. Cider is hugely popular right now in the Northwest, and I'm not sure what role we've all played. I mean, individually, we played our own roles, and it's hard to read, you know, what we've done as an association. But I feel like we made some kind of an impact. Yeah.
And what's the size of the association now?
Oh man,
we have 100,
upwards of near 100
members.
Yeah,
and then we have a lot of trade ally members. Yeah. I mean, that's the part of the association that's neat too, is we're able to, we get together as an industry, not only as the cider makers, but then we bring in all the juice processors and the bottle suppliers and all the supporting players. So it's really, especially in a place like the Northwest, where there's a lot of infrastructure already in the fruit growing and the tank manufacturing and all the equipment suppliers. Not just the cider makers make that family. Like, we're a big family. And so there are 100 cider making members now amongst the NWCA. But then we also have probably about 200 to 300 other trade ally members. I mean, we are, you know, Dave definitely mentioned the core value of the NWCA is to market better cider, but we're starting to get involved in some other projects as well, like our something Dave and I have worked on, which is a cider wiki. It's called the Cider Makers Toolkit, and it's basically an access point for cider makers across the country to learn from what I've learned and what Dave's learned and what other people, everyone, so people can start cider business is the right way. You know, how to deal with regulations, how to deal with growing your fruit, how to ferment the right way.
Bottling, you name it.
We're working on that. We've worked on a lot of legislation together to help change like growler laws in Washington to help get cider into growlers. We're working on a lot of grants right
now.
And
you can put cider in growlers.
Yeah,
we can put it in growlers.
When did that happen?
What started with Oregon? First.
Oregon was first, and then Washington was just 2 Bowled. Years ago they started doing it.
Yeah.
But that's huge for our industry because that's a value point for the consumer, a volume point for the producer. We're able to get a lot of great cider into people's hands.
Well, that's a lot of volume, though, to make, to be able to fill a growler.
Yeah. And some of the specialty products, it ends up being fairly expensive for a half gallon, but a lot of folks are doing growlettes to, you know, the 32 ounces.
Smaller.
And it's a nice low carbon footprint way of bringing your cider home. Yeah.
And I'm always kind of curious about growlers or growlettes. And so if I brought a growler from does each cider house or cidery have their own growler?
Not all of them, but I mean, a lot of them do now. I mean, if someone were to bring in anything of any size, I mean, we don't have a tasting room yet. We're working on, but if we were to have one, you know, we'd fill anything.
Yeah.
We'd figure out a way.
That's nice. I think that's a great way to go. And it does leave a smaller carbon footprint.
Yeah. And there's a lot of cooperative attitude towards all of our members and cider makers alike in the Northwest. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of chatting and working together.
Event coordination,
yeah.
Do you work with any other like cider associations in the U.S.?
Well, the U.S. Association of Cider Makers, our national organization, is one that, you know, we're all trying to push forth, and that's really where we're having our cider conference every year. We've had it in Chicago the last 4 years. We had it Salem, Oregon was the first one. It's coming back to Portland this year.
In February.
And it's a really important time for everyone to get together. You know, Dave and I are able to come out here to the Northeast, but we're only a few of many West Coast cider producers that need to learn about what people are doing on the East. just like the people on the East Coast need to learn about what's going on the West Coast. So we're able to, through the USACM, be able to do the Cider Conference. And we're also, USACM is really working on national government legislation to help with our carbonation tax, a lot of really critical issues that face our industry.
Yeah, alcohol percentage.
Yeah. Like taxation things that are actually holding cideries back.
And that's called the Cider Act.
Yeah, that's the Cider Act. It's actually something our company, personally, our company was affected by because we had some cider that was over, it was over carbonated, just slightly, just a little bit, but we got caught for it.
Who comes out and measures that? Like, are these like elf, like, I wish they were elves, right? You know, like,
they have little
are these suits? Are these suits, you know, that come out? I mean, I have
a feeling about black.
Yeah, exactly.
They actually have some scary bottle piercing tools that have a really heavy duty needle.
No.
Yeah, so the carbonation elves come out. Their names are T, T, and B. But the TTB comes out and they'll do a random pull and they go jab, and they'll jab your bottle, and then they'll test the dissolved CO2 in there, and if it's over a certain amount, we get charged a champagne tax.
Yeah.
Cider producers, that's a big deal. It's a change from 20 cents a gallon, basically, or 22 cents a gallon, up to $3.20 a gallon.
Huge.
So, because we got busted for that, we basically had to started or invited our friends down for the first cider conference in Salem, just as, like, it was 30 people that showed up for the first one, and it was, hey, everyone, guess what happened to us? Like, let's not do this again. And then it kind of snowballed, and we started doing the Cider Conference in Chicago. But it's been helpful for everyone to get together. I mean, Dave and I love hanging out with our colleagues. Like, the cider industry is super collegial, and everyone can teach each other a lot about what to do and what not to do.
Yeah,
that's precisely why we've come out here to Cider Days. It's kind of call it a traditional cider maker's rite of passage, and you know what Ben and those guys are doing here. It's been happening a long time, and it's awesome to come in and hang out with you know, like-minded souls.
We'll be speaking next about the difference between West Coast cideries and East Coast cideries with Nick Gunn and Dave White. But I'd like to take a pause to remind you to take time right now, or later, when you can, you're not driving, to subscribe to Cider Chat. You know, recently I was listening to a podcast. I have a MacBook, and I was just getting great tips. And I listened to the whole episode, and I never subscribed. And I can't tell you how difficult it is for me now to find that same podcast. I'm having to listen to every single podcast on the topic of MacBook Pros or Apple, and I'm having a heck of a time. So that you don't have that same kind of hardship, if you subscribe now, each week Cider Chat will come directly to your iPhone or your Android. If you're on Android, you can subscribe via Stitcher Radio. And while you're there, please leave a review and rating and share with your friends and family. This is Rhea Windcaller. I thank you, and you are listening to Cider Chat.
So what are you seeing the difference between, like, West Coast and East Coast? Because certainly there's, in the beer world, there is, like, West Coast hops, East Coast hops, you know, West Coast style.
We were just talking to Steve Wood about this just last night. You know, the terroir question, I think, still is 10 years away in our industry.
Yeah,
I feel like it's a long ways away.
Really?
But we need to do more trials on, like, what are the differences between varieties from, like, apple varieties between a West Coast Golden Russet and an East Coast. I think style-wise, I'd say because there's more producers, more players on the West Coast cider scene, there's maybe a little more crazy ciders coming out because you have to innovate more to become known on the shelf.
Well, you're saying there's more players today, but tomorrow, I mean, the amount of cider makers popping up.
Oh, it could change overnight.
Yeah.
It's insane.
And in the East Coast, I think it's like we were remarking, it may not be what it is in Oregon today or Washington today, but it will be very soon.
Yeah.
I think there's what you guys have, I lumped you into this pile too.
Well, I've been a cider maker for a long time.
You guys have tradition. This is why Dave and I love coming out to the Northeast. The tradition out here, the age of those orchards that you guys have, the varieties that have been around, they all came from here originally. The North American heirloom crops wouldn't exist if they weren't propagated originally in the Northeast.
Yeah.
And
so
the and history like, is here that we don't have out on the West Coast.
You can tell like the story. Steve Woods and his crew at Farnham Hill, and even Field and Judith and Terry Maloney at West County. Those guys inspired a lot of our early cider makers on the West Coast and in Washington and Oregon to make cider and help them kind of traverse the maze of like, well, how are we going to do this? You know, what kind of apples you need? What kind of equipment are you using? In fact, you know, the Maloneys at West County, they inspired, you know, one of my mentors, Rich Anderson at Westcott Bay. And, you know, so it's kind of like this never-ending chain of...
It's like lineage in martial arts.
And it started here. Yeah. I mean, literally started here, you know, and within an hour and 20 minutes from here or, you know, and some of the first apple trees in the country were planted here.
Well, Washington State is a huge apple producer, but, of course, we have New York State. I mean, that really changed during that whole Prohibition and Industrial Revolution and... You know, we left the cider, went to beer, and now cider's coming back again. And so, you know, there's sometimes a little bit of competition between the West and the East. And how does that play out on your end?
I feel like there's no competition anywhere.
I don't feel it at all.
I mean, we're coming from a place where, I mean, in Portland, there's, five cider bars now.
Yeah.
On all those, they only sell cider. Yeah, and some of them have, 30 taps of cider.
Yeah.
Seattle now
has two and counting. Yeah.
And then we have bottle shops that have hundreds of SKUs of ciders.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the coolers full of ciders. It's amazing.
Our businesses are still profitable and growing large amounts every year. At this point, because across the spectrum, there's the small layer of cider producers that are currently doing businesses. So it's so small that the concept of competition is like non-existent.
Yeah, there's so many more drinkers out there yet to find cider. And and as you know, somebody who somewhat recently actively sought out ciders, you know, I'd have to go to Oregon to pick up Nick's stuff, or you know, and there were like 3 craft ciders on the shelf, you know, aside from the 6-pack ciders, and I could find his, or I could go to select stores in Seattle and find another. Now, you know, the grocery stores can have, you know, a couple craft ciders, or you go to a bottle shop and there's like 20, 30 selections and on up. I mean, some of these bottle shops dedicated to cider, you know, they're 120 labels or more, and it's great.
Well, you know, certainly I think the West Coast has always kind of set that beat for the rest of the country with coffee, craft beer, and it's a duality that's happening in the U.S. around cider, you know, East Coast, West Coast, and you say the roots start here, but, you know, we're all kind of connected that way. But I wonder, when you said that you're seeing more cider in the stores, is that within like the last 5-year period?
Oh, yeah, easily.
5 years.
Yeah, I mean,
5 years. So we're saying like 2010.
3 years? I mean, it's been like an explosion.
I almost became a school teacher just like 4 years ago.
Oh, no kidding.
After 6 years in the business, I was thinking, what is going on here? You think this is going to have traction?
Huh. Maybe I was the only one buying this stuff.
So when did you see that? When did you see that kind of like really change? Like what was like, whoa,
well,
this is catching me.
I think that, so my business partner, James Kahn, I mean, we disagree on a lot of things, but one thing we agree on is like the confluence of events that really started the cider phenomenon. And there's, for us, we're really lucky to be in the Oregon area because a lot of people were already kind of ahead of the curve on these events. And that's kind of what you're getting at.
Yeah,
the Northwest and the West Coast are really pioneers.
On the food front,
doing kind of creative things. But for us, it was really the confluence of the gluten-free movement really, you know, starting to really pick up steam, the knowledge of what glutens do to your body and why maybe drinking a lower alcohol product, unlike wine, which is also gluten-free, cider is still gluten-free, but
more
yet
quaffable.
You can drink multiple glasses of it. The confluence then also of craft beer appreciation just going through the charts. I mean, Portland and Seattle have experienced insane craft beer booms, and then cider is really hitting in the craft beer markets. So those two things have been really big. And then the third one that we're really realizing now is just really our target audience is enviable. It's a millennial audience. It's this magic 20 to 35 year old male, sorry, 21 to 35 year old male and female, 50-50, unlike beer, which is heavily male driven. And so this millennial audience who has maybe some more money to spend and more willingness to try new things is jumping on cider right now. And they may be celiacs, they may be gluten free. They may just want to have something that's going to break up the maltiness in their mouth. And and cider right now is hitting all those areas. And so maybe we don't have the history, but we're finding a lot of success in the fact that this is just the right time right now to be making cider.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. It's definitely the gluten-free thing has given us a boost. You know, we were... At Whitewood, we were set to make cider, but along the way, we actually found out that Heather, my partner, was a celiac, and, and that's so lucky we're not making beer. Yeah, totally. I mean, on top of all of what Nick has said, I mean, I think I would add that there's in the Northwest, there's always been a strong connection to local. Well, maybe not always, but in recent years, been a strong connection to local and knowing where your food comes from and your drink comes from. And I think that folks like that. You know, they can relate with the local cider makers, and beyond that, I think that. You know, that turns folks on to other ciders too, because, you know, Spanish ciders have become kind of a thing, and French ciders, and certainly English ciders, which are actually some of my favorites, you know, that leads folks to other things. So, you know, it's all kind of attached to one another.
Yeah, and also I think with the millennials, they were brought up, their parents were drinking good craft beer.
Yeah.
So the expectation is there of something new and exciting. And what I find with cider is that you could do so many variations with that one apple tree to create something new and significant in that batch. It's just the sky's the limit. Certainly it is with beer too, but I have this feeling with the apple, it's way bigger where the sky's the limit.
Well, it was, I think you're hitting on also what makes it quintessentially American, that there's no other fruit that really strikes a chord with Americans than apples. Mm-hmm. Everyone has a story about what apples meant to them when they were growing up, what maybe they batches of cider they made accidentally because they left some juice in the fridge and they said, whoa, this bubbly stuff has some nice kick to it.
Yeah.
There's always a story of someone that has experiences with apples, cider. In the fall, it's a seasonally tied thing, obviously, but it's very core to our lifestyle here in America. And it's really exciting because that apple culture doesn't exist in many other places quite like it does in the U.S. And so we're kind of just hitting at the very base of where we are going to go in the cider world.
Yeah, I think we're just starting to find out what we can do with cider. I mean, not all of us experiment with yeast, but, you know, that comes in to play huge with, you know, how your cider turns out. But you could give, you know, three different cider makers, you know, the same bins of apples. They can crush them the same way, and they can ferment them, and they all have three vastly different products, you know, starting from the same apple, which is really interesting too, because then your style as a cider maker really starts to show, I think.
So what happens when you make your yearly, are you pressing throughout the year, or do you do one pressing, Nick?
Well, we, this year was kind of screwball. We have two brands, we have Wandering Angus and Anthem. Wandering Angus is made basically, or pressed and harvested one time, It's harvested during the fall. These are all heirloom apples, apples grown just for cider. Russets, pippins, crab apples, French and English bittersweets, apples that are rare, that have high tannins and high acidity and high Brix that really make unique, world-class ciders. And we press those once a year, and this year we've been blessed with a lot of apples. So we had them all come to us all at once. Last Friday, actually, we had 40,000 gallons of apples. Not apples in apple form, but juice. We sent it to another a processor that we've decided we're not going to be in the pressing business. That business is best done by professionals that know how to press apples. Wow. Because if you use it only once a year and then you have it set aside, it's not really an asset that's working for you. Yeah. And our press friends can actually do a better job of it. So they press in Hood River, they send it down to our place, and we'll ferment Wandering Angus in batches. We'll actually freeze some of the juice, bring it out, and make very dry, very tannic ciders. As opposed to Anthem cider, which is actually what a lot of ciders in America are currently made out of, just due to sheer access. Those are dessert apples, and so those apples, if you can buy them for eating, you can buy them for making cider. And we'll buy them year-round, kind of on demand, in juice form. And we have Brix acidity, total acidity, and pH specs from our juice processor. And we buy apple juice, and we bring it in, and then we'll ferment that. And Anthem ferments out lighter than Wandering Angus. It just has less tannins and acidity, and that will make a more quaffable, sessionable cider. Mm-hmm. It's a lower price point, and it's just more attractive to consumers who aren't looking for something like a wine glass cider, which is what we consider Wandering Angus. And so that Anthem is made in a year-round basis. Mm-hmm. Very different models. You know, Wandering Angus is more a wine model. Anthem is a little closer to beer. So we're having to basically run two different businesses.
Because of those two different specialties that you're focused on. I mean, because a lot of times a cider maker will say, well, this is our vintage level or whatever they want to call it. I mean, you can call it whatever you want.
Yeah.
And this is our more, you know, sessionable. Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's we're hitting different customers. We're targeting different people. I mean, what we would be, and that's the cool thing about what Dave and I in our competitive marketplace, and I'm using the stupid air quotes again, but there is no competition because Dave's customers are probably totally different from my customers. You know, Dave's customers are looking for ciders that are overpriced. No, I'm joking. I was about to start slinging your house. No, he just makes different ciders, and they're in a different package, and they're in a different restaurant, and people, they're totally different flavors than mine. Sure. And like Dave was saying before, even if we were to use the same juice and the same yeast, we would make two different ciders. And so for us, you know, we're hitting a different audience with Wandering Angus than we are with Anthem. They're just different people wanting a sessionable cider versus a higher tannin cider. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we do mostly, well, as far as volume's concerned, maybe not, but we focus mostly on seasonal fermentations as well. So we try to get the highest quality heirloom and when we're lucky, cider varieties and ferment them out, you know, at harvest, sweat them out.
And let's just talk about what sweat them out means because some listeners won't know.
Sure.
So if you just explain what that is.
You know, after your apples are picked, they're depending on the varieties, there's a certain amount of time. Also, depending on varieties that they like to sit, and waters are reduced, and sugars are created, and you get the optimum
tannins mellow,
and you get the optimum point at which to have your fruit pressed.
And the apples get a little sweaty.
Yeah. Like, actually, you can feel on a lot of them like a waxy coat on the outside. Yeah. And that's a great time. I mean, you can let them go too far, and then you're going to have, you know, you or your processor is going to have a rough time pressing them, but you're really trying to find that sweet spot. We do that a lot. We also have kind of outgrown our press, and so we count on like a brick and mortar press, you know, outside of Wenatchee to do some of our pressing. And we did a lot of pressing with Northwest Mobile Juicing this year, and Ryle, who owns this company, will take his truck and trailer And he, this year for me, took it down the Hood River and did a bunch of organic Newtown pippins, and I got three totes from that. And then he went over a week or so later and into Idaho and Fruitland and pressed me out 8 totes of Jonathan apples. And man, that was a lifesaver this year. Like,
yeah, so it's like a mobile juicer.
Yeah, and it's great. You know, he's got a trailer with a belt press, and in the back of his truck, he's got a diesel 3-phase generator to run it all. And all he really needs is a little bit of space and some water.
What's he driving?
I think he's got a big Dodge F-350 or something, you know, big diesel pickup.
Wow.
Yeah, he's great. You know, he's working on not to move this side, but he's working on a brick and mortar spot as well. But and then we'll also run this mobile press too, because sometimes it's easier to go to the apples than it is to have the apples come to you. We also actually kind of diversified ourselves into a sessionable cider over the last year. Again, ours is a little bit different. I tried to, you know, make something, again, different than what the other folks are doing. So we'll take a portion of our seasonal fermentations and blend them in with the sort of juice that we can order on demand. And we've created kind of a draft product that makes a good $5, $5.50 pint. Do a lot of keg sales. Our high-end top shelf products right now are in 750ml bottles, you know, kind of wine, champagne presentation with a crown cap. This new, when we get this, our sessionable cider bottled, we're looking at 12-ounce bottles.
12-ounce bottles.
Single sales, no 4-packs, anything at the moment.
And no canning.
Nick does canning.
Oh, yeah, we do a little bit of canning. We do just some seasonal canning for people liking to backpack and raft, and you don't want to carry glass with them. We, you know, just to piggyback with what Dave was saying about mobile juicing, what we have, and this is also back with the Northwest Cider Association and the big family we have, cider is very tied to place. You don't want to get too far away from where your crop is coming from. That being said, this is our blessing in the Northwest. We have a lot of apples in our area, so we have a lot of support around us. All the people that are really good at pressing, Hood River Juice Company, Fruit Smart, Valley Processing, Ryle at Northwest Mobile Juicing, they're all in our neighborhood, and we have everyone there. And so we can focus on what we do best, which is fermenting cider, packaging, branding, selling. We have help from juice processors. We have help from our growers. Everyone's helping out, and it's relatively easy. It's an easier path to entry in the Northwest than maybe other parts of the country.
Well, I don't think we have a mobile juicing unit that we know of.
Yeah, we didn't until this year either. And he kind of stormed the castle, as it were, and I think he pressed a little bit of juice this year.
He's
for
a little
folks.
Busy.
Yeah, he was he's running around. He's got another business, but
nice.
Yeah, it was like I said, it was a blessing to be able to work with him. I mean, I also actually, we have 3 miles or so down the road from me, I have there's a company that makes fresh cider, apple juice.
Sweet cider.
I haven't worked with them commercially yet. I kind of aim to do that, but I actually cut my teeth on their juice. You know, I'd go buy 5 gallons, throw it in a carboy, and experiment with yeast and stuff. So I'm looking forward to doing a little bit of work with them as well. It's really kind of what he says, let folks kind of focus on their specialty, whether it be growing apples or processing them or fermenting them and packing them.
You guys have really contributed to a huge boom in the economy at so many different levels with this new startup with the juicer, the mobile juicer, and just the cider bars. I didn't
mobile
realize.
Mobile canning and bottling.
Mobile canning, you know, it's just such a boom and a real, makes it a destination. So I would like to just ask you, just think about, like, for a listener who is, like, landing in Tacoma or landing in Portland, what would you recommend for them to do if they're, you know, because it's kind of overwhelming. You gotta, you know, besides like looking at your cider map, right?
Right, right.
That's a good place to start.
Yeah, go to the Northwest Cider Association's website.
Northwest Cider Association.
Mm-hmm. Northwestcider.com.
Mm-hmm. In the Portland area, like I said, there's a lot of good cider bars. Yeah. We have Bushwhacker was the first one in the country, and they've opened a second location now. Bushwhacker is a great stop.
You can get just about everything.
Reverend Nat's Cider is a great bar to go to. He mm-hmm. serves his own cider as well as other people's. Portland Cider, Cider Bite. You can come down the road to Salem, down to our place, but we're really focused not entirely on retail. We are open every Friday from 4 till 8, so you can stop by and see us. The Oregon scene is really heavily laden in Portland, though. I'd say there's probably like 15 cideries around the Portland area. Too many to list. Really, the best resources, like Dave said, would be the Northwest Cider Association. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know, what about in the Tacoma, Seattle?
Well, for Washington, a lot of the craft beer bars have bought into cider handles, and you don't just see one cider handle now, you'll see 3 to 5, and they're rotating our handles, and nobody's taking anybody's tap because you're just in rotation. Mm-hmm. But if I were coming to Tacoma, Seattle area, I would go to, Capital Cider on Capitol Hill mm-hmm. in Seattle. They're kind of Seattle's first cider bar. You know, it's a great place to really experiment. They've got bottle sales, mm-hmm. Glass pours, whether it's from the bottle or their vast selection of taps. They got a great kitchen there. Besides them, one of my favorite places is Schilling Cider House in Fremont, and they have an astounding amount of taps, and they're all cider there. They've also got, a vast selection of cider and coolers that you can purchase and take home or drink there. You can get flights at either of those places. Seattle Cider, like Nat's, mm-hmm, is mm-hmm, a great place mm-hmm. to stop because they're often, they've got their own ciders on tap all the time. But they've also got some guest taps coming through now and again, too.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Both have websites. I know that. You have two websites.
We do.
Right?
And I'm going to forget our Facebook and Twitter information.
You have the Twitter. I don't know if you want to go first, Dave.
I can go first. All right. Nick remembers.
Yeah, let me look it up.
I know what yours is for Twitter.
You can find us, on our website at whitewoodcider.com. On Twitter, we're www.cider. We're definitely on Facebook and Instagram. My original blog, while, poorly neglected or sorely neglected, it's been years since I've done anything, is Old Time Cider, and I'm also on Twitter as Old Timey Dave.
Nice. And how about you, Nick?
All right, well, like you said, we have two websites, wanderingangus.com, and that is our @wanderinganguscider is our Twitter. That's our Twitter, @WACider. And then our other website is anthemcider.com. So you can find information in both Wandering Angus and anthemcider.com. And I'm really obviously not the guy to be asking these things because I'm the production side of our business.
No worries.
I forget them every time.
No
James,
worries.
My business partner, I apologize for not remembering.
Don't worry,
he'll
James.
You when he returns.
What I will guarantee is that this will be on the show notes to this episode. So if folks want to follow that, we'll have all that information, including some of the sites that you're mentioning, the cider bars and the mobile transport too. Hey, you guys, thanks a lot for talking with me.
Thanks for having us.
Time.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah. We love being out here in the Northeast.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we enjoy having you, and I'd love to come out and see you out on the Northwest at some point.
CiderCon, anytime.
CiderCon, yep.
CiderCon 2016.
It's coming up.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, Ciderville, that was a delightful time and so much info. And I have links to all the different areas that they talked about, such as the cider bars, the Cider Act, the different associations, and certainly their own websites. And that is Wandering Angus and Anthem Cider in Salem, Oregon, and Whitewood Cider in Olympia, Washington. And my apologies to the citizens of both Oregon and Washington. You are so not alike, and yet you are uniquely similar in that you live in a beautiful, beautiful region. I have spent time in both states back in the day when I did quite a bit of mountaineering. So, yes, I climbed Mount Baker and yada, yada, yada. In fact, I do want to mention that it's really Oregon that I credit with kind of turning me on to craft libations. I still remember that first pint of red ale. Wow. Craft libations. Now, I'd like to move on to the reading list that I mentioned earlier in the show from Peter Montgomery. And I'm going to only mention two books right now because it's a good list and I don't want to try to jam it all in there. And don't worry, because I do have links, again, to these books where you could find them. The first is really a perfect timing for the holidays. So if you want to get a jump on the gift book season, this is a great way to do that. What better to give to your favorite cider maker or cider enthusiast or apple orchard care person? It just makes it so easy. So the first one is called A Potted History of Fruit, A Kitchen Cornucopia, and that's by Mike Darton. And it essentially is two illustrated gift books. So there you go, the gifts. And they'll tell you about little fun facts and give you some beautiful photos to look at. It'd be a really nice gift. So there's going to be a link to that. And the second one is titled The Perfect Fruit: Good Breeding, Bad Seeds, and the Hunt for the Elusive Plot. And that's by Chip Brantley. And that's what they consider the go-to book about the plot. This is the creation story of the perfect fruit. Are you intrigued? I certainly am when I read that title. And again, I want to really thank Peter Montgomery. If you want to find out more about those books, just go again to the show notes for episode 4 on ciderchat.com. Well, next week, I again have an amazing episode, and that will be with Paul Zacco from Zach's Homebrewing. And this gentleman, he became like the cider maker of the year for 12 years in a row in New England. And he's just a really insightful, enjoyable guy, if not a little bombastic in all the best ways. I think you have to be that way if you're a cider maker. Just a wee bit. So I guess I would put myself in that crowd. Maybe I'm not an amateur cider maker. Maybe I'm a little bit bombastic in the best of ways. Oh, he'll never forgive me. Oh, yes, he will. So I look forward to seeing you next week in Ciderville. And in the meantime, I hope you're able to grab a great glass of cider and toast to all. And this is Rhea Wincoller signing off for now. I'll look forward to seeing you next time in Ciderville.